Okay, look at this.
Benjamin Netanyahu is a war criminal. The Benjamin Netanyahu should be arrested and tried for his crimes.
Now, look at this.
McDonald's, and to be honest, Burger King. I like Burger King.
What is going on here? This is a global leader, and the mayor wants to arrest him while he's sitting down for a podcast at the exact same time. This is Benjamin Netanyahu, and he's not a leader like Putin or Kim Jong-un, who seems so inaccessible as to be almost impossible for us to understand. Netanyahu sits down with podcasters, with influencers. He speaks English with a Philly accent.
You will not recognize the Palestinian state.
No, because of the associations with the word state.
He's on TV, and he visits the U.S. all the time. He's also the subject of an International Criminal Court arrest warrant. No matter what you might think of the country of Israel, that they might be our greatest ally or our hidden enemy or both at the same time, there's no debate that their Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, is one of the most consequential and powerful people in the world today. But at the same time, I think Netanyahu is deeply misunderstood. I don't think most people my age, or most people in general, truly understand who and what Netanyahu is. Although if there were one person in the world today whose story matters more than anyone else, it probably is Benjamin Netanyahu. Let's get into it. Okay, so Benjamin Netanyahu is born in Tel Aviv in 1949, just 1 year after Israel is first formed. Actually, he was born specifically on October 21st, which means we have the same birthday, which does make me feel a little weird. Anyway, in 1947, the United Nations votes to split the territory of Mandatory Palestine in half, allotting 55% of the land to a Jewish state. The Zionist leadership accepts, but the Arab leadership refuses, and the country collapses into civil war as five Arab armies invade on the same day the nation of Israel is formed.
Arabs and Jewish nationals fought each other bitterly and relentlessly. Terrorists on both sides rose to fanatical heights of killing and destruction. The Jews wanted a homeland. The Arabs were just as determined that they would be forced to leave.
In the end, over 800,000 Palestinians, more than half of every Palestinian alive, are driven out or flee from the newly formed Israel, and over 400 of their villages are bulldozed, blown up, or planted over with forests. Ultimately, there was nothing left for them to return to. An entire society, with its own cities, newspapers, their own ports, their own farms, they cease to exist, and the state of Israel is built on top of it. I actually never really understood just how big the Arab society in Palestine was before Israel was formed, but it was significant. For a century, Palestine was known for a unique breed of oranges they had cultivated in the 1800s. After they fled or got expelled in 1948, Israel passed a law that transferred all of the Palestinians' property over to them, including the orange groves. They quickly rebranded the oranges, taking it from an object of Palestinian national pride to an Israeli product. Obviously, though, that's only one small example of how things worked during the formation of Israel, or as Palestinians call it, the catastrophe of 1948. But anyway, although Israel is where Netanyahu was born, that's not where he grew up, because Benjamin Netanyahu, Prime Minister of Israel, actually grew up in Philly, like Philly, Pennsylvania, like the U.S. Specifically, from the age of 7 until he was 18, Benjamin Netanyahu lived in Cheltenham, this relatively small, sort of suburban town that sits directly to the north side of Philly. And so for the most part, Benjamin Netanyahu lived a normal American childhood. He and his brother Jonathan attended public high school. As a teenager, he played soccer. He was a member of the debate team and the chess club. Now, the reason that Benjamin Netanyahu grew up in Philly instead of Jerusalem is because his father was a Zionist historian and he took a job teaching Hebrew language at this university. There was one more note I took while I was reading Netanyahu's biography that really stuck out to me. He talks about how when he was a kid, he used to go visit his uncles who lived in New Haven, Connecticut, and he would ride in his uncle's boat along the Long Island Sound by the beach in New Haven. And that really stuck out to me. As you guys know, I grew up in New Haven. That's my hometown. I used to go to the beach by the Long Island Sound, and that was strange for me. That was kind of like this feeling of, I don't know how to equate it to anything, but realizing you went to school with him. The story goes that at the age of 18 in 1967, Netanyahu did not attend his own high school graduation ceremony because he had already gone back to Israel and enlisted in the Israeli Defense Force. His brother Jonathan was also already in the military. He had graduated and gone to join the IDF 3 years earlier. But Netanyahu arrived in Israel to enlist in the military immediately after the Six-Day War, a short and violent conflict that resulted in the seizure of five major territories to the south, east, and north from their neighbors of Syria, Jordan, and Egypt.
It's just over 60 hours since the long simmering Middle East crisis boiled over into full-scale war.
This was a massive conquest that more than tripled the size of Israel's land and put their eastern borders just a few dozen miles away from Cairo. Now, it's generally understood in Israeli media that once he was in the military, Benjamin Netanyahu was a sort of secret commando that fought bravely for the IDF until he was wounded in the line of duty and honorably discharged. And, well, that is kind of true, but it's also not really. Netanyahu actually was in the Israeli Special Forces, and he fought in a bunch of different battles, but the most widely reported story from his time in the IDF is that he actually got accidentally shot in the shoulder by someone from his own squad while they were participating in a rescue mission, and so ultimately his military career unceremoniously ended at the age of 22. Afterwards, though, Netanyahu ends up going right back to the United States to live in Boston and study architecture at MIT. So while Netanyahu is in school at MIT, he first finishes his architecture degree in just 2 years, and I don't even know why this guy wanted to study that in the first place. But then right after that, he goes and finishes an entire MBA in 1 year, and then he starts working on a PhD in political science, and he did all of this even while taking a short break to go fight in another war in Israel in the middle of his studies. And so this is where the Benjamin Netanyahu that we know today begins to truly take shape, because it's in this moment where his life is kind of at a fork in the road. He seems more focused on academics, possibly going into a career in business, at the same time that his brother Jonathan is tragically killed at the age of 30. During the raid on Entebbe, an operation to rescue civilians that had been captured by Palestinian forces and had their plane diverted to Uganda, his brother Jonathan ends up being the only person who's killed during those events. And this does two things for 27-year-old Benjamin Netanyahu. For one, it makes his family famous. Jonathan was, again, the only Israeli soldier to be killed in the process of saving almost every hostage, and his death made him a national hero. Jonathan Netanyahu got parks and schools and streets named after him. There's actually even a big memorial sculpture named after him in downtown Philly. Basically, Israelis and Jewish people love this guy. It's even widely reported that people started naming their kids after him after he passed. And here's the second thing. It gives Netanyahu a purpose, although we're going to have to wait a minute to find out what exactly that means. But after his brother's death, Benjamin Netanyahu doesn't go back to Israel. He actually goes to work in consulting. This is actually really weird. Like, forgive me for laughing, but it's really hard to imagine, like, a future international criminal, fugitive, dictator, authoritarian leader, war criminal, walking around, like, modern downtown Boston at 27 years old, making spreadsheets for, for projects and, like, running meetings with clients. But that is what Benjamin Netanyahu was doing in the late 70s. I actually found a note that weirded me out even more than that. It says that while he was working at BCG, Netanyahu became good friends with future American politician Mitt Romney, who also worked at BCG, and they both had offices on the same floor of the company's downtown Boston headquarters. Anyway, what's really important right now is that you see this.
Do the Palestinians have a right to a separate state?
No, I don't think they do, but...
This is Benjamin Netanyahu, going by the name Ben Nitte, speaking on a Boston public TV program at 28 years old in the late 70s. And this is his first time ever appearing in public. Really, this is Netanyahu becoming the Netanyahu we know today. This is him building the same playbook that made him a prime minister. Really, this is him building up a platform that's both violently against and yet also highly reliant on terrorism.
They're terrorists, and the fact that they seek our destruction, I don't think they're a partner to negotiation.
So let's take a break for a second, because terrorism is the one word that is going to keep coming up here. Terrorism is the basis of Netanyahu's platform even before he's a politician. Terrorism killed his brother. It almost killed him. But what he really means when he says it goes a lot deeper than you might think at first. This is a truly important part of the story, and it's something I never really understood before working on this project. Well, first, I'm gonna be honest with you guys. I have no real interest in watching grandmas in Israel get blown up by Hamas rockets. That stuff is terrible. But the more I researched this video, the more the word terrorism, it doesn't seem to fully capture what's really going on in the dynamic that exists. There's an interesting article I found called Instruments of Dehumanization, written by a law professor from the University of Colorado, and it describes this part of Netanyahu's career a lot better than I personally can, so we're going to use that to help us get through what's really going on. So this article basically explains that before the late 70s or early 80s, terrorism was both not a frequently used word and that its meaning was far different from what we understand it to be today.
The story of Israeli lawfare against Palestinians begins with the concept of terrorism. Indeed, it was far more common for events we now associate with terrorism, like hijackings and bombings, to be described as forms of insurgency. These insurgencies were understood as driven by concrete and understandable grievances rather than by evil or immoral intentions. For instance, mid-20th century analysis of violent revolutionary movements occurring in places as wide-ranging as Vietnam, Kenya, Cyprus, Northern Ireland, typically framed those formations as engaged in strategic opposition to a regime.
I know that sounds really weird, that society didn't automatically view terrorism as an evil act in the past, but it basically is true. Let's look at the words of Walter Cronkite. This guy was the most trusted and most well-known journalist in the world in the late 60s, the early 70s, and this is how he described terrorism. Specifically, the Dawson Field hijackings. That's when Palestinian forces hijacked five commercial airliners on the same day. He would say,
"Palestinian guerrillas, in a bold coordinated action, forced the world to confront a problem diplomats have been shoving aside."
He didn't say terrorism. He didn't say, you know, these terrorists attempted to blah, blah, blah. I mean, when you're looking at it like this, you could even say that something like the American Revolution was full of terroristic activity. But anyway, the reason I'm telling you all of this is because the one person that did the most to change our understanding of terrorism in the world today is arguably Netanyahu. Well, anyway, Netanyahu is now 30 years old. He's been living in the US for a long time. He even got married to a non-Jewish woman at this point in his life. But after working in Boston in consulting for some time, he ends up returning to Israel and founds a nonprofit called the Jonathan Institute. And the purpose of the Jonathan Institute, named after, of course, his brother, is to have conferences and write books aiming to promote a better understanding of terrorism. But in reality, the goal seems to actually be to redefine what exactly terrorism means. Let me read you a quote.
"At the first conference, the Netanyahus peddled a novel view of terrorism that presented it as a satanic threat from irrational, demonic enemies that was anathema to Western values of freedom and democracy and aimed to destroy the West itself. In order to save themselves, Netanyahu's father would argue, Western countries would have to abandon their commitments to international law and multilateral UN-led action. Instead, they would have to use whatever means were necessary to annihilate the threat of terrorism."
So Netanyahu is running conferences where he's trying to redefine what Palestinian forces are doing in their insurgencies against Israeli occupation as something utterly morally corrupting, from which the Palestinian insurgents can never be forgiven for. And so what effectively happens is he's erasing these threads of liberation or self-determination from the Palestinian story. If you can turn the world's definition of terrorism from something that's part of a bigger conflict into an unquestionably evil act, you can redefine how the whole world sees the conflict and make it a totally one-sided issue, where Israel is always the victim. Now, the Jonathan Institute existed for a number of years and published a couple of books and hosted a variety of conferences that included many prominent US politicians as guests, but eventually, Netanyahu once again finds himself working a regular corporate job. For a couple of years in Tel Aviv, Netanyahu would then work as a marketing agent at a furniture manufacturing center, but eventually he ends up getting suddenly appointed to the second highest ranking job at the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C., and he moves back to the U.S. again. After a couple of years in the U.S., he's appointed as Israel's ambassador to the United Nations, where he then goes to live in New York City. Side note, there is a widely reported tale from Netanyahu's time at the UN of him becoming friends with Fred Trump, President Trump's dad. I don't really have any details on that, but it is something that keeps coming up while I'm reading articles. But More generally, you might be wondering how Netanyahu made all these crazy jumps, and at a fairly young age, too. After all, he's only 35 years old when he gets appointed to be Israel's rep to the UN. And I think I would say that the main reason for all of this is that he was really good on television.
But I thought we turned a leaf. Perhaps I was wrong.
What we want to see here is a new beginning. The terror is the old world. It's the old fighting. But essentially, it's in their interest to disgorge these people, and the sooner they do it, the better. I think they're in the process of doing it.
We are concerned with Israel's borders, with Israel's security.
There's a lot of videos that go viral sometimes of Netanyahu talking on TV in the past. I'm sure you guys have seen a few of these. I've played a few of them on the screen. I always see them on Instagram Reels. It's like Netanyahu in 1993 warning about the dangers of Iran building a nuclear bomb next month. Usually it's just him doing some kind of bizarre fear-mongering or talking in his weird Philly accent. But these clips are actually pretty significant. Because what Netanyahu was really doing is he was building the world that we all live in today. He, and really his father as well, had spent years developing this new framework for how American politicians and the public could understand political violence in Israel. With the Jonathan Institute and their conferences and their books, he helped move terrorism into the center of the Western political imagination. But specifically, he took away its understanding as one tactic inside a larger political conflict and made it a self-contained force of evil that was really aimed at destroying democracy. And it worked because he was a guy who was both an Israeli political figure and raised in Philly. He sounds American. He has a career and a life in America. He seems reasonable and normal. I mean, you can see this even today when he goes on the Nelk podcast, and the most famous clip that comes out of it is Netanyahu asking them where they like to eat burgers. And then, you know, it turns out Netanyahu doesn't like the quarter pounder.
I like the Whopper. You have to get the Whopper with two beef patties.
And as funny as that is, it's also like highly significant to the entire arc of his career. Netanyahu became this uniquely capable person at selling ideas to Americans. He could take the conflict between Israel and Palestine and translate it into a simple story. You know, and especially because this is the late 70s and the 80s, this is the Cold War, he's able to tell this story about like democracy and its enemy, terrorism, civilization and its enemy, terrorism, the West against terrorism. And that was, you know, basically a small adaptation to an already broad narrative that most people didn't question. And I think on the other hand as well, it is also his TV appearances in the US that ended up being the root of his popularity back in Israel. The US and Israel weren't really like cultural allies the same way we are today. Not as many Israeli public figures commonly spoke English or even like American style English like Netanyahu did. So Israelis also understood that his way of fighting for Israel was fighting for Israel on the global stage. So it was a totally mutually beneficial dynamic, and it ended up making him a highly influential and well-known Israeli figure at a pretty young age. Of course, I mean, Netanyahu didn't create American support for Israel from scratch, but he kind of was one of the first Israeli figures to achieve mainstream recognition in American political media, and that ended up giving him a big edge back at home, too.
You will not recognize the Palestinian state?
No, because of the associations with the word state. That means that such a state could build a power, a strong military power, an army with missiles.
And so in the late 80s, when Netanyahu goes back to Israel for good after working at the UN and the embassy, he has a seat waiting for him in the Israeli government. But first, we do need to understand how exactly the Israeli government works, because it's pretty strange. Israel's government is centered in a parliament called the Knesset, where 120 members of the Knesset represent a lot of different parties. Right now, even, there are 12 parties in the Knesset. At the same time, though, they're kind of all right-wing or far-right. For example, right now, parties advocating for Palestinian statehood only represent 10 out of 120 people in the Knesset. Anyway, Netanyahu joins the Likud party, which is a solidly right-wing but not extremely right-wing party, at least by Israeli standards, and by 1993, he becomes the leader of the Likud party. But Netanyahu doesn't really start making a name for himself in the Knesset until he starts calling for people to kill the prime minister. Let's get into this, okay? This is Yitzhak Rabin. He was elected prime minister of Israel in 1992, and he brought a generally more centrist and progressive approach to a lot of issues. Now, specifically, Rabin oversaw the Oslo Accords, a peace treaty that mandated that Israel would recognize the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, as the legitimate representative of the Palestinian people, and that the PLO would recognize Israel's right to exist, and that Palestine would renounce terrorism, and that Israel would assist them in setting up a government for Gaza. But anyway, it wasn't even really anything conclusive. The Oslo Accords weren't a settlement or a declarative creation of a Palestinian state. They were really just an interim agreement that both parties would try to figure it out together sometime in the future. So Prime Minister Rabin and the President of Palestine, they shake hands in front of Bill Clinton at the White House, and the international community celebrates the start of a new, more peaceful relationship between these two nations.
Enough of blood and tears.
However, there was a problem.
Tonight, as Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin took Israel on its uncharted course, Jewish demonstrators were already on the streets. Struggles broke out. The right wing, the settlers, the opponents of territorial compromise were trying to show that Israel will be deeply divided if the Palestinians are given autonomy.
Many more right-wing fundamentalist Israelis and Palestinians did not approve of the deal. Right-wing Israelis didn't want to be stopped from creating more new settlements or to surrender a territory they already settled, and Palestinians felt that the peace agreement would only continue the occupation they were already living under. And so this led to the Oslo Accords being followed by a sharp increase in brutal, deadly suicide bombings by Palestinian extremist groups all over Israel.
One Palestinian car bomber tried to ram a military checkpoint, but killed only himself.
Before the Oslo Accords, actually, Palestinian suicide bombing wasn't even broadly understood as a thing. But in the 2 years after the Accords were signed, there were almost a dozen attacks that resulted in around 100 Israelis murdered. And so the Israeli right-wing response to these events was to outright demonize Rabin as having directly caused these killings himself. Likud and other conservative parties would depict him as a Nazi in an SS uniform, and at rallies, they would chant, "Rabin is a murderer," and "Rabin is a traitor."
Rabin is a traitor!
And Netanyahu himself would be instrumental in what comes next. It's widely reported that at this point, Netanyahu, who is the leader of the Likud party, goes to direct a rally that features a mock coffin for PM Rabin, as well as a noose, with posters that say, "Death to Rabin." The story goes that Netanyahu is actually warned after this by Israeli counterintelligence that there is a real plan to kill the prime minister, and so they request that he moderate his rhetoric, although Netanyahu refuses to comply and continues to say the same stuff in public.
The PLO, Islamic State, 15 minutes from Jerusalem or 5 minutes from Tel Aviv, is a prescription not for peace, but for dangerous and renewed conflict.
But either way, it was too late. In November of 1995, at the end of a peace rally in support of the Oslo Accords, a 26-year-old far-right Israeli ultra-nationalist shoots Rabin 2 times in the chest and kills him. And any hope that the Oslo Accords could have brought for the future of Israel and Palestine dies with him.
Through the night, many Israelis simply stood in the streets and wept. The death of Yitzhak Rabin is a national trauma.
A lot of this info came from a New York Times article I was reading, and I think that there's one line in particular that says a lot.
Rabin looked at the sweep of history, not the latest polls. He knew that there was no escaping the moral corrosion involved in subjugating another people. With Israelis and Palestinians claiming the same land, only compromise between them could truly bring security in the end.
It seems that that sort of attitude somewhat died with Rabin. So that's not very nice. But seriously, I mean, I don't think becoming a victim of extreme political violence at the hands of people inside your own coalition is highly likely to ever happen to any of us. I mean, if it is, maybe I should be friends with you because you sound like an interesting or powerful person, but it's probably worth knowing who to call if it does. Because there's a reason why Morgan & Morgan is America's largest injury law firm. For over 35 years, Morgan & Morgan has been fighting for the people, and they've recovered over $30 billion for clients who have been injured by someone else's negligence. Hiring Morgan & Morgan is kind of like hiring an army to go into battle. They've got more than 1,000 lawyers and 100 offices nationwide. So maybe you've been bitten by a dog, maybe you've been in an accident, maybe you were the victim of a secret program that left you unable to remember what your name is, maybe it was MKUltra, but whatever the situation is, if you're ever injured, you can check out Morgan & Morgan, who will fight to get their clients the best possible result. And best of all, their fee is free unless they win. So remember, if you're ever injured, you can go to forthepeople.com/Volksgeist and see if you've got a claim. So a few months later, Netanyahu is elected Prime Minister of Israel, and he knew exactly how to use this moment to his advantage. Netanyahu's campaign focused narrowly on the idea of terrorism and security, although specifically his idea of terrorism security that he had developed years earlier. The Jonathan Institute and its ideas, this description of terrorism as a demonic, pervasive evil, it became Netanyahu's playbook for how to approach the candidacy. And so throughout this process, he becomes known as Mr. Security. He promises that he's going to abolish the Oslo Accords. He says that Israel will no longer recognize Palestine politically, and he's going to crack down brutally on Palestinian violence. And for him, this is the solution to Israel's problems. In the end, though, he barely beats the sitting prime minister, really, literally by a margin of 1%. But he becomes prime minister of Israel on the 29th of May, 1996.
And by early this morning, there was a growing feeling that Benjamin Netanyahu would be the next prime minister, a man whose politics are based on the deepest fears of the Israeli people.
And once he gets into office, though, Netanyahu rapidly becomes highly unpopular. For one, he wasn't able to stop or even slow terrorism. Fighting between Israeli forces and Palestinians actually increased during his first term, and he also never abolishes the Oslo Accords at all. In 1997, he even cedes back land to Palestinians. In the West Bank, he gives back the city of Hebron after Israel had annexed it earlier, but that isn't it. At the end of 1998, he and Yasser Arafat traveled to the U.S. and signed the Y River Memorandum, an agreement that laid out a path for the Oslo Accords to continue and for Israel to remove troops from the West Bank while Palestine makes stronger commitments to stopping terrorism. Basically, what I'm saying is that Netanyahu's first term was politically equivalent to if Mamdani got elected to be mayor of New York as a democratic socialist and then got into office and was like, hey, I'm MAGA now. It essentially just made Netanyahu look like a terrible, incompetent politician who literally had no idea how to do anything and was possibly just working in the opposite of his own party's interest. And so Netanyahu's right-wing allies called this Y River Memorandum a huge betrayal. Within 6 months, his government actually collapses, and in Israel, if their coalition breaks off into separate parties the way they had been before, the government collapses and a new general election is called. And parties can break off from a coalition if they think the prime minister has broken his promises, and so ultimately this is exactly what happens, and a new general election is called. And Netanyahu loses this election by 12 points. He loses it actually to Ehud Barak, who serves for a couple of years and then eventually goes on to become a super close friend of Jeffrey Epstein. Ehud Barak literally was like a major character in the video I did on Epstein a couple of months ago, and literally is probably one of the top three closest contacts Epstein had in the last decade of his life. Anyway, Netanyahu had alienated basically everyone. The right wing thought he gave up too much territory. He was a sissy liberal. It was the exact opposite of their agenda of expanding Israel's borders. And then the left thought that he was deliberately sabotaging peace because even though he's giving the land back, he's still being a total authoritarian towards the Palestinian people. So basically, Netanyahu's general reputation as prime minister was ultimately not even good inside his own party. He was even known for being difficult to work with, having big issues with his own people and his own administration, not compromising, not being a good or pleasant person. I found a bunch of quotes on how people felt about Netanyahu inside his own party from a New Yorker article written about 25 years ago. So the article says,
"One of the things I did upon arriving in Jerusalem was to call Yitzhak Shamir, the previous Likud prime minister. Shamir picked up his phone on the first ring, as if he had been waiting for the call all week. He said, 'Bibi,' in an exhausted tone, 'he is not a very trustworthy man. He's too egotistical. I personally have no contact with him. He's a man who is not very popular. He's talented and successful, and he made it at a young age, but people don't like him. I wouldn't say he's admired. I don't believe he believes in anything. He has a huge ego. I don't like him.'"
That is literally a quote from someone inside his own party. The author also got a quote from Shimon Peres, the guy who was acting prime minister right before Netanyahu got elected.
"We've lost so much and for nothing. Netanyahu's only consideration is his own coalition. He's always worried about losing power. That is always his first priority. In the meantime, we've lost the trust we built up. We've lost the Arab world. We've lost the respect we won throughout the rest of the world. And all of this makes it appear that we are a bizarre nation. To achieve peace and not follow through is bizarre."
It kind of actually seems to me, from a lot of what I read and researched, that in the mid to late 90s, the mainstream Israeli outlook on Palestine was pretty far different than what it is today. I just read you quotes from people in Netanyahu's own party criticizing him for being useless at achieving peace. That's not the state of affairs that exists now. I'm not saying that things used to be great. These people were not proposing Palestinian equality. But in general, there was an understanding that peace was far better of an option to work towards than indefinitely protracted war. I think they seemed to understand that, like, it was important at least to have peace, even if just to save their own asses. And that's not what you see in the Israeli government today. A survey in 1999 actually found that 65% of Jewish Israelis supported the creation of a Palestinian state, and 70% preferred pursuing peace over planning for more military action. In 2026, both of those numbers now are below 25%. Again, though, I'm not saying that things used to be good. There was a ton of brutal violence on both sides in the 90s, but I do think that there was verifiably more interest in making things better through compromise versus the morbid and horrifying decay that we've fallen into now. And I think it's actually far easier than you might imagine to see how this decay ended up happening over the last 25 years. So Netanyahu is prime minister of Israel for 3 years, but ultimately he leads a highly unsuccessful government and he gets ousted. And so for a while, I guess he just disappears and does media appearances. He's probably back in the US, grifting somewhere, being on TV. But what really matters is what happened in Israel without him, because Palestinian and Israeli relations actually got much, much worse in the 2000s.
"The Palestinian Minister of Labor warned that the Israelis' reoccupation will reap a bitter harvest.
Both sides seem willing to strike and to retaliate with ever greater force."
Now, this is pretty oversimplified, but following the failure of the Oslo Accords, Hamas gained power in Gaza, and this leads to the killing of more Israeli civilians and more terror attacks, while Israel responds to that with blockades and attacks of their own. And so throughout the 2000s, you see a very violent cycle begin to calcify.
"Prospect of the emergency peace summit is viewed by many young Palestinians as almost meaningless. And in Gaza today, the make-believe coffins of America and Israel were taken through the streets. The message was ominous for those who hoped the violence may have abated. At a funeral this afternoon for a young man killed by Israeli forces yesterday, the call was for revenge. Down with the olive branch, they shouted. Long live the rifle."
Hamas uses Israeli attacks and the blockade to justify further violence, and they strengthen their claim that armed attacks against Israel are the only remaining option. Israel uses Hamas's rockets to justify tighter restrictions and even more force. And throughout this entire process, civilians on both sides are absorbing the consequences. Although the destruction and death in the densely populated, impoverished Gaza is for the most part drastically worse. And so ultimately, the position Israel and Palestine are in at this moment is much more violent and less safe and worse for everybody than even before the Oslo Accords were proposed. Because, I mean, like I said, it wasn't until after this period that suicide bombings even became a thing. Most historians point to the same underlying cause of this escalation: the failure of the Oslo Accords. And there's one person in particular who did more than anyone else to cause that failure. It's Benjamin Netanyahu. Meanwhile, Netanyahu has spent the last few years regaining his favor in the Likud party, and on February 10th, 2009, he officially becomes the leader of Israel again, as always on the promise of increased security during a moment of high-stakes fear of terrorism and violence. In June of 2009, the then-recently elected President Obama gives a speech at Cairo University in Egypt where he announces that the United States does not support any further Israeli settlements and that there must be a two-state solution implemented.
"So let there be no doubt, the situation for the Palestinian people is intolerable, and America will not turn our backs on the legitimate Palestinian aspiration for dignity, opportunity, and a state of their own."
Netanyahu, in return, gives a very similar speech back, where he actually agrees that there should be a Palestinian state. He does give a long list of insane controls that Israel would have over the Palestinian state, including not being entitled to their own airspace, having no weapons, having no borders, having no defense treaties, but either way, this Bar-Ilan moment was an unexpected new approach. In reality, though, the biggest moments of Netanyahu's second term are basically the exact opposite of Palestinians getting their own state. In fact, by 2015, the Israeli government would actually make an announcement that Netanyahu's earlier speech about the Palestinian state, as authoritarian as it would have been, was totally recanted and was always invalid. I don't know, okay? One big thread of Netanyahu's second term as prime minister was actually a massive expansion of settlements throughout the West Bank. Although expansion is kind of underselling it. There was really more settler invasion of the West Bank under Netanyahu than any other Israeli prime minister in history. Actually, through this whole period, the settler population grows at about double the rate of Israel's own population, and while settlements were previously developed under the guise of being neutral, in 2017, Netanyahu's government directly begins building their own settlements. But the real story of Netanyahu's second term is the conscious decision to allow Hamas to stay in power. Hamas had really only gained a true foothold in Gaza in the 2000s. They didn't control the atmosphere or the politics there before at all, but at a certain point, as Hamas's attacks continued killing Israeli civilians and keeping the country in a very tense and dangerous state, Netanyahu's government made the conscious, active decision to let them stay in power in Gaza, because for as long as they did, there would still be just enough justification to avoid allowing a Palestinian state to form, so that Israel could continue to expand and control the entire territory. If Palestinians could organize around better leadership, they could coherently push for their own liberation. As long as Hamas stood in the way, they can't. And so, in a very sick and twisted way, Hamas slowly became the key to Israel's plans. Allowing their terroristic acts to make the Palestinian cause look despicable and violent was absolutely perfect for Netanyahu's government. But I'm not describing a theory. We literally know that this is Netanyahu's playbook. In 2018, Israel allowed millions of dollars a month from Arab states to cross into Gaza in the form of cash in suitcases. They knew everything that goes across the border, and they did this with the knowledge that Hamas would use the money to buy weapons to use against them. They did this with the knowledge that Hamas would use the money to buy weapons to use against Israel. I said that twice for a reason. It's unbelievable. But there are recordings from a meeting where Netanyahu tells people that Hamas needs to exist because it prevents the Palestinian state from forming. So not only is he against Palestinian statehood, Netanyahu is literally in favor of letting Hamas kill Israeli civilians and terrorize the country so he doesn't have to compromise with the Palestinian people. This decades-long obsession with security and terrorism, his singular focus about stopping terror and securing the country, it's all out in public that this was good for Netanyahu because it made further settlement and further control and further domination of the people possible, while it made Palestine look worse and worse than ever before.
Netanyahu told his faction that whoever is against a Palestinian state should be for transferring the funds to Gaza, because maintaining a separation between the West Bank, which was controlled by the Palestinian Authority, not by Hamas, and Gaza, controlled by Hamas, helps prevent the establishment of a Palestinian state.
I know what you're imagining probably comes next, but we have to wait for that. Because even after all of this, Netanyahu's second term actually culminates with public revelation of deep internal corruption. First is Case 1000. Prosecutors allege that Netanyahu and his wife Sarah had received the equivalent of $200,000 in luxury gifts from a variety of billionaires in return for help lobbying American officials for their interests. One of these people was actually a Hollywood producer of movies like Gone Girl, Fantastic Mr. Fox, Bohemian Rhapsody. Great filmography? I don't know what he's doing fucking around with Netanyahu. But the next case of corruption, case 2000, revolves around Yedioth Ahronoth, one of Israel's biggest newspapers. So Ahronoth was historically critical of Netanyahu. They were not Netanyahu supporters. But in 2016, Israeli investigators discovered recordings of secret conversations between Netanyahu and the paper's owner, where they discuss an arrangement that the paper would make their coverage friendlier towards Netanyahu, and Netanyahu in return would promote legislation to weaken other newspapers and protect theirs. But that's not all. Of course, that's not all. In this case, third case, case 4000, Netanyahu allegedly pushes regulatory favors worth hundreds of millions of dollars to the owners of Bezeek. Bezeek is the biggest internet provider in Israel, and they are the parent company of a popular news site, Walla. Anyway, it's widely reported that Netanyahu did this so Walla would not run negative stories about him or his family, and instead, they would attack his political opponents, and they would write unusually favorable coverage for his news topics. Basically, Netanyahu turned one of the biggest companies in Israel into a personal propaganda machine. And so Israeli investigators actually planned to indict Netanyahu on these charges as far back as 2018. Although when the case they were building against him became public knowledge, his response was to reframe the charges as a witch hunt and an attack on his character and a plot by a corrupt anti-Israeli faction of the government. But still, in 2019, Israel's attorney general formally indicts Netanyahu on charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust, and a trial is set to begin in 2020. And so Netanyahu is the first Israeli prime minister to ever face a criminal indictment. But in the end, he sits for 98 hearings between 2024 and 2026, and even today, no verdict has been reached. So 2019 to 2020 was a super volatile time in Israeli politics. They had four general elections in 2 years as controversy around Netanyahu whose trial resulted in a rapid-fire succession of government collapses again and again. I mean, basically, even Netanyahu's own people don't want him in office at this point. Ultimately, Netanyahu is removed from office. For the second time in his career, his government collapses and he gets voted out. His response this time is to declare that it was the greatest election fraud in the history of the century. Either way, though, it would only be a year until he's up for election again, as the government that formed in his absence couldn't agree on anything beyond that they didn't like him. Even while he was gone, Israel went through two government collapses and two different prime ministers, even just while he wasn't there. And so, after winning his third prime minister election at the end of 2022, Netanyahu's next move is to make it so that he can never be removed from power again. By Israeli law, a sitting prime minister doesn't have to resign when he's indicted. He only has to resign after a conviction, which can be appealed multiple times. You guys can probably imagine where this is going. So less than a week after Netanyahu is sworn in for the third time, his head of justice announces a plan to completely rewrite how Israel's court system works. Because Israel has no constitution, and really not a lot of checks and balances in general. In the entire Israeli system, there's one institution with the power to check the government, and that is the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court's main tool for doing that is a doctrine called the reasonableness standard. It lets judges strike down government decisions or appointments or firings if they're found to be extremely unreasonable. I know that sounds vague, and it is, but this is a country with no constitution, and so the only mechanism standing in the way of Netanyahu is this reasonableness doctrine. So, with that in mind, here's what his overhaul proposed. First, the government takes control of the committee that selects judges, including the Supreme Court justices. Great sign, okay? Then they want to add an override clause that lets a simple majority of 61 out of 120 Knesset members repass any law that the Supreme Court might ever strike down. He basically goes in and proposes outright destruction of the only check and balance against his government. The reaction to this inside Israel was unlike anything else in the country's history. Mass protests break out almost immediately. It just doesn't stop. There are hundreds of thousands of Israelis in the streets protesting Netanyahu every week for 9 months. Military reservists, including Air Force pilots, they announce they're not going to show up for duty if the overhaul passes. Tech companies and business leaders, people start fleeing the country. The Israeli stock market starts to slide. Their currency gets devalued. And so in the end, after much fear and protest, the Supreme Court strikes down the judicial overhaul 8-7. Just one vote prevented Netanyahu from becoming a dictator for the rest of his life. If this had passed, Netanyahu would forever be immune to anything he had ever done. And then, A month later, the countryside of southern Israel erupts in flames as Hamas forces lead the first large-scale invasion of Israel since 1948. They launched thousands of rockets into Israel, killed hundreds of civilians, and burned and destroyed homes and farms, while they took 251 hostages in the process. Hamas did stuff that I can't even say in this video. It was genuinely tragic. But what happens next is going to be both far worse yet also great for Netanyahu at the same time. Because Netanyahu's government would respond to October 7th by beginning to genocide everyone in Gaza. Since October 8th, 2023, more than 83,000 Palestinians have died. 30% of them were children. 85% of the people the IDF killed weren't Hamas, they were innocent civilians. And in total, they killed over 5% of everyone in Gaza, and ultimately, the conflict has been declared a genocide by the UN. The IDF bombed everything. 80% of all structures in the Gaza Strip are damaged or destroyed. Gaza City is now mostly deserted. Perhaps worst of all, people starved. Electricity and fuel were cut off, and food and water were cut off for months. They stopped food trucks from entering. Eventually, Gaza was declared to be in a phase 5 famine, with over 500,000 people experiencing starvation. And so after a year of brutal conflict, the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant against both Netanyahu and the Israeli Minister of Defense for war crimes of starvation, as well as murder and other inhumane acts. All 125 International Criminal Court member states are now required to arrest Netanyahu should he enter their borders. All of this is the natural conclusion of the Netanyahu playbook that he's been building for more than 50 years. For Netanyahu's entire political career, he's been promising security that's never come. He's been fighting against terrorism, but he's never stopped it. What has come is more death and destruction and suffering for Israelis and Palestinians, at the same time as Netanyahu has only accumulated more and more power. In his fight against terrorism, he's created a situation where continued terrorism increases his influence. Even inside Israel, Netanyahu has become widely hated. There have been massive, sustained, and continuous protests as many Israelis felt Netanyahu had allowed the hundreds of hostages taken by Hamas to be forgotten while he pursued a bloodthirsty war instead of trying to bring home their family members. And Netanyahu's approval rating today within Israel is about 38%. That's pretty much the same as Trump here in the US. He is still facing corruption charges, but he continues to appeal to avoid the trial. And so even today, Netanyahu walks free in an astounding and horrifying way. Because Netanyahu, as of 2026, is a regular guest on various podcasts. He gives speeches before Congress. He goes in 60 Minutes. He even gives many of his press conferences in English, not Hebrew, so American audiences can better understand his announcements. And I think this is probably the biggest part of what Netanyahu has done for Israel. He's pushed American patronage of his country further than any Israeli leader ever did. And so ultimately, the first thing he did in his career, which was becoming a media personality, is today the last thing holding him up. Netanyahu spent years in America. He practically is an American. And ultimately today, we are his last remaining constituency as our tax dollars go to propping up his crimes against humanity. And this is a state of affairs that seems to have been largely originally sustained by his contributions to American political media, the American political sphere. The rest of the world has largely turned against Netanyahu. I mean, he's broadly understood to be probably the most evil leader on earth. And even the American public has finally begun to realize his crimes. But the US government still financed the destruction of Gaza, both through Biden and the Trump administrations. President Trump just recently was calling for the cancellation of the corruption trials against him. AIPAC still operates in our country, bribing our politicians to support a country engaged in genocide with corrupt, felonious leadership. I mean, there is a lot I did not get to talk about in this video. I didn't talk about how Netanyahu spent 30 years fear-mongering that Iran was weeks away from building nuclear weapons. I didn't talk about his relationship with President Trump. I didn't talk about Israel's insane influence within the American Senate and the House, and the implications of that. It's a very deep-rooted atrocity. The story of Israel and Palestine is a very, very sad and a very, very long and exhausting story. I think the idea that I could simplify every detail of it and Netanyahu's contribution to it into one video would be impossible. I would have to ask, do you want to go back 50 years? Do you want to go back 100 years? Do you want to go back 200 years or 500? Or do you want to go back to the time of Christ? My personal opinion is not that there should be no Jewish state. I'm not saying that Jews don't deserve to have a place to live. At the same time, though, it looks to me, after all this research I've done, like if there were one person in particular who set Israel on the course it's on right now, it would be Benjamin Netanyahu. I can't tell you if the Oslo Accords really would have worked. I can't tell you if Netanyahu would have won if not for Rabin's death. I don't know. But Benjamin Netanyahu has been Prime Minister of Israel for 25% of the country's existence. And during that time, he's presided over more disasters than anyone ever did before, as Israel's relationship with Palestine has deteriorated into a seemingly uncontrollable battle to the death, while Netanyahu's power has only increased more and more. What Netanyahu has done to Israel is not good for Palestinians, and it's not good for Israelis either. It's a horrible state of affairs for these two groups of people who both do deserve peace. And I'm not saying that Israel's behavior towards Palestine before Netanyahu was ever fair. I think we pretty clearly illustrated that it wasn't. But it seems to me that in the one moment when it might have improved, when history could have gone in a different direction, Netanyahu showed up and made sure that that never happened. And he succeeded. On the 4th of November, 1995, minutes before Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin was killed, the peace rally he attended before his death began to close out with a performance of a famous Israeli song called Shir LaShalom, the song for peace. And after he died, a blood-soaked piece of paper with lyrics to the song was found in his pocket. And I'm going to read the last verse to you guys. It says, "Don't say the day will come, bring the day about, because it's not a dream. And in all the city squares, cheer for peace."